I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. July 2020 is a hot midsummer like none in memory. It's COVID's rebound summer, a politically distant Trump-Biden campaign summer, a movement summer in many varieties. Black Lives Matter is the national brand of grassroots power. Many brands abound at the local level, like the Daughters of Incarcerated Parents, organizing around their firsthand experience that prisons do not work for almost anyone. This hour, we are sampling the driving spirits of this movement summer in and around Boston. Typically, these are homegrown inside agitators, so to speak, working on the issues and in the neighborhoods that formed them. You may notice that there is excitement and goodwill in their voices. They like to say there is beauty as well as power in what they're doing.
I think people are starting to realize that we cannot look towards the system to really reshape itself, and it's really up to us to start creating everything that we need that we didn't get.
The newest generation that are younger than I, they work even harder. They work really hard.
My parents really raised me and my siblings from a very young age to understand the beauty of African American history and the beauty of resistance history.
We're fighting the same thing. We're focusing on the same system. You know, we have to think about how all of this ties together so we can really effectively get at the root of it.
Andrea James strikes our keynote. She's a Boston lawyer who did 18 months federal prison time most of a decade ago for running over banking regulations. Inside, she first formed Families for Justice as Healing. Outside now, she can see that she has mentored a generation of reformers coming into their own.
Well, I see a level of brilliance and humanitarianism coming out of the hearts and minds of young people in our movement that surpasses anything I think that we've experienced in the history of abolition and movement work.
Andrew James, we first talked with you about coming out of prison, women in particular, 5 years ago. What has changed?
The people that are most directly affected have found a voice. They have brought chairs to the table. The result of what we're seeing with uprisings and calls for defund the police, reallocation of resources, money, an end to incarceration, abolitionist viewpoints, principles, and advocacy frameworks, that's a result of most directly affected people standing up and saying the policies that continue to be created are not policies that actually transform ourselves and our communities. They're policies that help keep in place white supremacy. They're policies that help keep in place things that are harmful to our communities. The people who are most directly affected are now saying, look, these are proven failed systems that are currently in place. We've taken the time to look at all of these policies over the past 10 years, and we've determined that those policies and those answers are not going to get us to where we want to be in terms of living in communities that are thriving, that are not affected by occupation by police and law enforcement practices, that aren't entangled in a criminal legal system that continues to overrepresent people from our communities. And I think that's what's different.
Andrew James, let's look back as we look forward. Almost 5 years ago, we did a program with you about women in prison, women coming out of prison. It was early Orange is the New Black time in popular culture. You had done time yourself. As you say, this is not outside agitation. This is inside agitation in communities and families that know the problem. And yet it's grown incredibly broad. How has this evolved?
I was in a federal prison. I was a trial lawyer, a lawyer who practiced criminal defense and also real estate conveyance. I got in trouble as a result of a real estate conveyance infraction, and I was sentenced to serve 2 years in federal prison. I'm from the most incarcerated corridor in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, between Nubian Square and the Franklin Hill Franklin Field Housing Development. I came into that work with a lot of personal experience growing up in Roxbury mm-hmm. with people entangled in the criminal legal system. I became a criminal defense attorney, got that experience. And then I became an incarcerated woman, and I was sent to federal prison in 2010 when I was in prison. That's when the new Jim Crow came out, Michelle Alexander's book. That's when Piper, our dear comrade, Piper Kerman's book came out, Orange is the New Black. And also it's the same year that Democracy Now! And other journalist organizations exposed ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, and their nefarious practices of engaging state, ultra-conservative state legislators in building the infrastructure and the framework legislatively for mass incarceration. Mm-hmm. And so all of those things came together in this alchemy that caused the country to understand at a very early stage that things needed to change, that millions and millions of people, predominantly Black and Brown people from cash-poor communities, were being churned in and out of this carceral system. There were all kinds of consequences heaped on top of just being a woman who was incarcerated. And even though all of this was coming to light, as 2,000 women that were crammed in a prison, we heard nothing about women. What got us onto a prison bunk? What were the mostly psychological, emotional issues that landed us on a bunk? Why did this have to happen that separated us from our children, that created this cycle of incarceration within our families? And so we decided in that prison yard that we were going to organize ourselves. We didn't know how. Hmm. And so that's what we did. We started organizing in the prison. We created Families for Justice as Healing. And that led to where we are now with the National Council for Incarcerated and Formerly Incarcerated Women and Girls. It's a national organization of thousands.
You qualify as a founder of this movement and a heroine of this generation, but can you explain them?
Their lives and their commitment to doing work on behalf of liberation and equality for all people comes from this alchemy of life experiences that they've had.
Interesting.
These leaders are directly affected by a criminal legal system in their local community that has deeply affected their lives. And we planted the flag and said, we're going to do everything we can, not starting from a criminal justice reform space, but literally standing on the principles of abolition. We are women who have been in a prison and know that it will never be a place to heal and advance our lives. And the resources pouring into it need to be reallocated into the communities. We can stop the flow of our people into prisons if we have the resources to create thriving communities.
What is the institutional base of this movement that compares with the Black church from the start of the civil rights movement in the 1950s, Martin Luther King Jr. most famously? But what is the ground of this movement today?
I really don't think it's an institutional approach. I mean, it's part of abolition work. This is a people's movement. It's a movement that's coming from the streets. Hmm. It's a movement that is being led through a people's process, through people's assemblies that are on the ground looking at where things are being allocated now and thinking about how is this shift going to help me and our people to transform our communities to healthy, thriving communities that are being literally led, not by these massive institutions, but from people in hyper-local areas within their communities.
How do you measure progress 5 weeks ahead, 5 months ahead, 5 years ahead?
We're going to win, and we know. So that's progress. We have organizing projects that are happening now around the upcoming elections. Hmm. You know, you are no longer going to be able to run for office representing people in our community without you coming and being co-signed by the community and actually making promises that you will deliver on or you will not be in that seat any longer.
Wow.
We have civically engaged people at a level that has not been seen since Dr. King and the civil rights movement. We are pushing a statewide campaign to end incarceration of women and girls, that in Massachusetts, we have one of the smallest incarceration populations of women in the country. And so those are short-term wins on our way to the long-term win. Our goal when we sat in the prison 10 years ago, Chris, was to end incarceration of women and girls.
Will that hit a ballot question at some point?
Oh, yeah. We're coming. We're hoping that it won't even have to get to a ballot initiative. We know this is possible. We are at the threshold, at the door. We know it's inevitable. The country is evolving. The state is evolving. Women are the majority. We speak to women every day about this issue. They understand this. The reasons why women land on a prison bunk are reasons that you should never incarcerate a woman or girl for. We can do this, and we can be a model for other states of how to do this. And we will. We're going to get there.
Andrea James, people worry about democracy dying, but everything you're saying about communities of talk and study and action, it all sounds like the real thing. Growing again.
We're in a fight. And all of those things that we're creating through a people-led process, education, awareness, centering Black Lives Matter, centering the lives of the value and the lives of Black people, because by doing that, we all advance our lives. The structural racism in this country has been upheld by policies that have been led through what were supposedly a democratic process. That is not true. And we have to not be afraid to talk about that and to own that. The people who have been most directly affected aren't waiting any longer. And I think we are right now the pillars of democracy.
Andrea James, you're a great advocate of it and have been for a long time now. Keep doing it, every bit of it.
Well, thank you, Chris, for allowing our voices to be heard. And thank you for understanding the beautiful leadership of all of the young people who you've been speaking with. Thank you for amplifying and elevating their voices and ideas.
Coming up, Ayanna Aalborg remembers a powerful presence in her growing up, who was absent most of the time in prison. This is Open Source. We're catching individual voices in the collective spirit of summer 2020. Ayanna Aalborg founded Sisters Unchained when she realized that the peculiar circumstances of her life were not so rare.
My name's Ayanna. I grew up in Cambridge with my mother and my three siblings, and my father was incarcerated for 17 years. So he was incarcerated when I was born. The first time I ever met him was in a jail. It's definitely been a journey. You know, growing up, I would create different images of him and just try to like piece things together from my experiences in the visiting room, just trying to figure out who this person is. Most of my memories are visiting him in the federal prison that he was incarcerated in New Jersey. And so traveling hours to get to New Jersey. The prison is legit out in the middle of nowhere. Definitely a little scary too, especially as a young child. You have no idea where you are. So I don't know. I just got to know him. I feel like throughout his entire life since he was young, you know, he's been in and out of jail since a teenager. You know, he's probably had to wrestle with like showing the courts and just proving like his worthiness, you know, his character and all of that.
Who's the man you got to know?
The man that I got to know, he was a dreamer and very goal oriented. He would teach me how to do research. One thing that he really taught me was like how to teach myself and whatever I put my mind to go after it. And even if the opportunity isn't presented to me, like I could create the opportunity. There are certain like things that my dad has instilled in me from prison that really important to bring up, that like I feel like people think that when parents are incarcerated they disappear forever, or that they're not parenting from behind bars, and that's a common misconception. That's not true at all. Like, you know, my father was helping me with my homework growing up. He's the reason why I got into college. Like, I would send him my college essays and like he would edit it through email and things like that.
Your father was absent, but he was a presence too.
A strong presence, yes.
When did you start thinking about not your problem, but a general problem?
Definitely was when I joined a group called Youth Against Mass Incarceration. with a group of kids from Roxbury. They created the group because they were tired of being harassed by the police just from walking down the street and really wanted to do something about it. Came together to learn about abolition and what does that mean. Went to a meeting with my best friend. I just remember leaving that meeting with the book, The New Jim Crow, that they gave us. I felt something in my spirit. Like, I just felt very activated. I don't know. I also felt empowered, too, because I feel like they gave me language to experience that. I knew something was up, but, like, I didn't have language for it. For example, being in a visiting room and, like, everybody in the visiting room was Black. But me being young and not fully understanding what racism is or putting two and two together, like, saying, oh, this is racist. But just seeing, like, mothers hold their child's hand or, you know, just, like, kids running around the visiting room and just like families being and seeing also too, like a lot of Black men just being in a very loving space with their families.
These are daughters of incarcerated parents, I take it.
Yes.
But you made a leap to see it as coming out of slavery.
Yes. The heart of the matter, and I think that this is the point in terms of parental incarceration and how it parallels with slavery, is just that America has been separating Black families since the beginning of time, and it almost feels normal for our family structure to not be together, you know? I started from my experience of having an incarcerated dad in my life. I definitely am passionate about working with incarcerated and formerly incarcerated women because so often their stories aren't being lifted up and being brought to the forefront.
Ayanna, I'm fascinated in this summer of discontent, all kinds of activism. Black Lives Matter is the most famous, of course, and the biggest, but they're all connected, I suspect. You've got a small, intense unit of young women raising consciousness, making connections, looking critically at the justice system, the police system. Fit yourself in the big picture.
As part of a growing suspended and movement family in Boston, that's part of a growing movement in the country. This current moment is very important because I think people are starting to realize that we cannot look towards the system to really reshape itself. And it's really up to us to start creating everything that we need that we didn't get. It looks like children and parents staying together, being reunited. It looks like young people not being charged as adults, but you know, asking, you know, what do young people need? What do teenagers need? Having more access to mental health services, having more access to educational opportunities, increasing funding in like Black-owned businesses, parks, like the need for resources that will really help them heal from like substance use. I don't know, just looking at a person for their humanity, really.
What might look different at the end of this summer from your organizing? What might look different in 5 months to the end of the year?
So in 5 weeks, I think one, we're going to be seeing a lot more people throughout the entire state talking about abolition. We're going to be pushing for conversations that really get to the heart of, do we need police and prisons? In terms of 5 months, I think that our actions are going to be escalated, especially because we've seen throughout this entire pandemic that incarcerated people are not prioritized. And I'm hoping that we, in 5 months, we could get our sisters or most of our sisters home who deserve to be reunited with their families.
5 years, 2025.
To be honest, I really believe that the police force in Boston is going to shrink. I think we're headed in that direction. And in 5 years, I think there's going to be less violence. You know, why are we investing millions of dollars into a police force that's not even really solving the cycles of violence in our communities? And it's been going on for decades.
That was Ayanna Aalborg. Armani White is an agent of Reclaim Roxbury. On his way from Boston Housing through Wesleyan University, he discovered his purpose in the gap that Ayanna just described between what he had been told about the world and what he could see for himself.
I think I got really involved as a younger person who was doing quote unquote the right thing, more or less, but still being stopped and frisked. I remember there being a commercial at one point around, you know, if you don't pull up your pants, you'll be arrested. There's a potential you can be ticketed. So that's the Boston that I grew up in, like post-race. There was no issues, you know, about race. Obama's president, shut up and pull your pants up and do good. But that's not what the world that I lived in or experienced.
What was your world growing up, Armani?
I grew up in part in Bromley Heath, now Mildred Hilly Projects. My grandmother helped raise me along with my beautiful parents. Growing up, I was always focused on trying to do good, but I also always had a, you know, sense that there was something not right around why we had so much, you know, wealth in the world, why there was so much that some people had and so little that my, you know, that I saw my neighbors had and my friends and family. You know, I went to a private high school after having gone to Boston Public Schools, got into a private high school on scholarship, and seeing the wealth disparity. Both my parents also are formerly incarcerated, so understanding how a Corey can affect your opportunities in life, how you can work really hard and try to overcome that, but how that's, it's hard to overcome. And so, yeah, that's kind of what I saw growing up as a young person, is what you're told and expected around how things were supposed to be if you worked hard versus what the reality was for a Black man, a Black person.
Armani, when did you feel you were entering a movement, if that's what you call it, or a network, or a generation, making a connection?
I think around 2011, 2012, me and a couple friends were like, okay, we need to do more than what we've been doing. What do we like to talk about? What do we think other people would like to talk about? And we started like doing like a book club around the new Jim Crow book. And it really got us excited around getting together other young people, the young Black and Latino people, young men and women who were affected by the criminal justice system.
This is Michelle Alexander.
Yeah, I got together and to talk about the criminal justice system as folks who were the children of people formerly incarcerated who have been arrested and, you know, either went to jail or been, you know, spent the night or just had to, you know, to deal with the criminal justice system through being stop and frisked or, you know, pretextual stops or just driving, you know, driving while Black, whatever the case may be, however you're connected, wanted to create a space to talk about that. So we started an organization, Youth Against Mass Incarceration. And I think at that moment, I started to realize that there was other groups doing that similar type of work. Around that time, Trayvon Martin was killed. There was groups like Team Defenders that popped up in Florida, and we like sent letters of support to them. And I think that's when, for me, I started to realize, like, oh, wow, this is like a, you know, nationwide movement around criminal justice reform and the way people of color are treated.
Armani, when are the moments when you say, yeah, we're gaining? On the street, with cops, with family, with people you don't know, that you feel we're making inroads. People are beginning to get something.
Nowadays, you see it with the removal of statues and symbols. You see painting, you know, Black Lives Matter being painted on the streets. You see, you know, in Massachusetts, for example, we had sweeping criminal justice reform, albeit not complete. It was stuff that people had been fighting for a while that was able to pass with the criminal justice omnibus reform.
Armani, there are people like me, call us older folks, but who remember the civil rights movement and the anti-war movements, the 60s, very, very well. We were in the thick of it. But we have a hard time placing your generation. You're different. You're patient. You're pragmatic. You're incredibly intense and radical in a sense, and yet you're open to huge new things, complexity, many campaigns, and you keep working. How do you describe the difference between your gen and anything anybody's ever seen?
Right. So I look back to them and I'm like, man, our generation could learn a thing or two. Like, I don't think that we're going as hard as they did, right, personally. Between the, you know, SNCC and SCLC, I, you know, don't want anyone listening to this to think that I at all think that we're working harder than them, because I don't think we are. And I think we need to go harder. I think we have social media and cool graphics. And there's also a commitment to, you know, to queer leadership, to woman leaders, to making sure that Black people, low-income people are being listened to. And yeah, there's an appreciation and a support for, you know, non-gender conforming people within leadership, which there might not have been back in, or there definitely wasn't. And there's also just, you know, a certain level of not really caring about respectability in the sense that we don't need to look a certain way to be right. But I do think in terms of the work ethic, we could learn a thing or two. Although I do see with these Zoomers, the newest generation that are younger than I, they work even harder. They work really hard.
What connection do you make or not make with old-fashioned electoral politics, getting state reps or congresspeople like Ayanna Pressley or Rachel Rollins elected?
Super, super important.
Have you been in those campaigns?
so yes, I'm a separately from, you know, I'm a steering committee member with Right to the City Vote, which is a multiracial working class led electoral project in the city of Boston, where we work to elect progressives and also to build the power of our communities. And so, yeah, we worked on the Rollins campaign and
the DA. Yep.
Yes. And so, yes, I think electoral politics is extremely important. I think that I am personally, like, over the years come to learn, you know, I think as a young activist, you're like, you know, screw politicians, they're all corrupt. But you learn quickly that you need fighters on the inside. So I think it's super important to answer your question.
Armani White, thank you for your citizenship. Thank you for this conversation.
Thank you so much.
Fatima Ahmed leads the Muslim Justice League in Boston. She's a child of Egyptian immigrants who found herself growing up in the Appalachian fringe of Western Maryland. She learned to speak up, she says, because she had to.
I grew up in Cumberland, Maryland, which is nestled in the Appalachian Mountains out in Western Maryland. It's essentially like West Virginia in terms of, you know, sort of Appalachian culture, very small place, very white. And grew up with a lot of, you know, overt racism, including, you know, active KKK outside of town. And the 9/11 happened when I was in the ninth grade, like, you know, just within the first few weeks of high school. And so that really transformed my experience. I mean, it had already been pretty difficult, but I think even that same day, like riding the school bus home, this kid who I knew, who I grew up with, you know, was saying, "Are you going to hijack the bus?" And, you know, continued to be called like a terrorist. So it was really, really hard. I was a shy, introverted kid who just, you know, totally wanted to disappear in that moment, and yet could not disappear. Like, me and my whole family, we were very noticeable. You know, there were maybe like 6 or 7 Muslim families in Cumberland. And I started to speak up only because I had to. Like, again, I was so shy. I was very quiet. And yeah, had to find a way to convey my own thoughts and feelings, because even the people around me who wanted to stick up for me, you know, they didn't quite understand how to do that, right? Thankfully for me, I was able to move to North Carolina for college.
Fatima, how did the community organizer from North Carolina take root in Boston? And what is your work now?
In North Carolina, I, you know, was really just starting to learn about community organizing and, you know, started doing workshops on Islamophobia, and Trump got elected, and that seemed really even more pertinent and important work to be doing. I, you know, learned about Muslim Justice League, where I work now, because Boston was a pilot city for the Department of Homeland Security to do this countering violent extremism work, which is now like the core of our work at Muslim Justice League. And then within a couple of months of me learning about MJL, they were hiring, and I jumped at the opportunity to be able to work at a small organization that's really focused on the systemic roots of policing and surveillance, and not just how it impacts Muslims, but how, you know, Muslims are used for testing these sort of national security frameworks that then get applied to everybody else.
So how do you connect with this extraordinary generation of organizers about incarceration, police work, housing, and the people?
Boston, honestly, I think is a great place for connecting with other organizers. Many of the folks that we're connected to, or that I'm connected to, have this same framing, this underlying foundation of knowing that, you know, we can't be siloed, right? That is not effective, right? We're fighting the same thing. We're focusing on the same system, which has many different faces, right? And manifests in all of these parallel ways that impact different communities. And so we can't just come at it from my specific identity as like a Muslim woman, you know, we have to think about how all of this ties together so we can really effectively get at the root of it. And I think Boston has, you know, the first police department, which the Boston Police Department loves to have on their website. I forgot that. Yeah, there's a long history of policing and surveillance here, and there's a long history of resistance that I'm glad to be a part of.
How do you describe this generation of activists? Is it rooted in COVID, in George Floyd, in Black Lives Matter?
The younger folks who are getting involved right now, I mean, they've grown up with this, right? This precarity that we're all facing because of the economy, because of intensifying violence against poor people, against Black people, against trans people. But I think what is really moving the deep work that is happening right now is people knowing there can be and there has to be a better world, and that we can actually do that.
Fatima Ahmed, thank you so much.
Thank you. This is really lovely.
Coming up, Queen Wade's self-education in the beauty, she says, of resistance history. This is Open Source. Queen Cheyenne Wade is another child of Cambridge Public Housing and public schools and a graduate of Suffolk University. She had a lot of home training in Black liberation struggles long before this movement summer of 2020.
The word unprecedented is used a lot, but I think it is definitely able to be used now, I think on one hand, but also on the other hand, I do think that this is a continued struggle. I see myself following in the footsteps of my parents and my grandparents and my great uncles and my great aunts who were also fighting for housing rights and for African-American civil rights and doing this work when they were young and going out to protest and continuing that legacy. I see that as a continuation. And so I never really like to think of any of these movements as disconnected or thinking that this is a different movement than a movement that was happening 20 years ago, because I like to think of them as resurgence, as a generation learns and understands more. And our political times have intensified. I think it was kind of the perfect spark to the flame that really ignited so many people across generations and across borders and across these kind of man-made lines to kind of understand that this is a movement that we need to stand in together, that Black liberation doesn't actually just mean Black liberation. It means the total liberation of all people who are not seen as human, are not seen as equal. And in our society, Blackness and the idea of Black identity is what is seen as most inhuman. So if we are freeing Black people, that means we are able to free all people. And I think as people understand that concept more, we are able to move more towards building these bridges and building that solidarity, which I think has been an amazing thing that we've seen in Boston and around Massachusetts in the past couple months.
I want to hear your story, your own story inside your project, but inside this moment. How did you get to be Queen Cheyenne Wade?
I was born and raised in Cambridge, Massachusetts with my mother and my father. And they both from a very young age taught me about African-American history and taught me not to be ashamed of my history as an African-American person and in my African-American culture and heritage. There is a large stigma that is put on a lot of people in African-American communities that we don't have a culture because of the systemic cultural genocide that many enslaved Africans went through while, you know, undergoing the process of the Atlantic slave trade. And that is something that is still kind of talked about today. And my parents really raised me and my siblings from a very young age to understand the beauty of African-American history and the beauty of resistance history in America, which I think African-Americans and Black people in America have always been linked to in some of the most beautiful ways. And then in terms of just music, I think was one of the most beautiful things. My dad really helped us understand our history as Black Americans, and through resistance, through beauty, through community, through music, you know, through Sam Cooke and through Stevie Wonder and through James Brown and through some of these really incredible people, we were able to kind of build this revolutionary, I guess, playlist from a very young age that my father definitely, I would say, pushed me towards a path. James Brown's I'm Black and I'm Proud, you know, that was played a lot in my household to shape our pride and our beauty and our culture just as much as anybody else's here in America. And that it is integral to understanding American history is understanding Black history. And so that was something that I always am very thankful for my parents for really grounding me in understanding my history. And of course, throughout all of this, I was reading. Reading
what, if I may ask?
Angela Davis, of course, Women, Sex, and Society, as well as Are Prisons Obsolete? The autobiography of Malcolm X was one that my parents showed to me at a very young age, but I had to come back to it, obviously. And then The Black Radical Tradition, which is a collection of essays that really changed my view on how to better organize for our communities and how to better kind of call for justice. And specifically, I think some of the essays that Fred Hampton and Claudia Jones wrote were really, really life-changing for me and really understanding how to move forward.
Describe the project or projects that you work on every day this summer.
So some of the campaigns and projects that I have been a part of have been the Boston Mutual Aid Fund, which has been organized by myself and two other amazing organizers, Samaya Zama and Zubaydah Khan, who after the May 31st rebellion, where the police were just really inciting terror and violence on the youth that had peacefully come together at the State House that night, we had all come together kind of understanding that we needed to build solidarity with the protesters and especially the Black and Brown youth organizers who were on the ground. And so that was a really big wake-up call to many of us that we needed to start building bridges and building that solidarity. And so we put out a mutual aid fund, and we have been getting so many generous donations and been able to help so many organizations, as well as Black Boston and FTP as well, which I am also a part of.
And that stands for?
In being able to help. FTP can have a variety of names. It can really be whatever you feel the name can be. It can be For the People. It can be Fund the People. I don't know if I'm allowed to swear on this new show, but it is the police. It really is intended for the actions that we are directing. So if we are talking about defunding the police, it's FTP. If we're talking about For the People, giving funds to the people, it's FTP. And some people, especially a lot of mayors, have been very adamant about trying to villainize us as Black and Brown youth for standing up for our rights. But I do think it's really important for people to remember that we are youth. And it is very important for people to remember that these are youth who go out every single day and put themselves, you know, at risk. A lot of us do have family that are immune compromised. And a lot of us are out here for necessity, because if we are not out here, who else is going to be? But beyond that, I'm also a part of a collective in Cambridge, in my hometown, called Community For Us By Us, or Community FUBU for short, which has been working on similar abolitionist demands in defunding the Cambridge police and reallocating those funds to the Black and Brown communities that have been extremely underserved in Cambridge for generations, as gentrification has been sweeping the Cambridge community and specifically Black, Brown, and low-income communities in Cambridge. And then there are a couple other initiatives that I've been working on as well, organizing with Lisandra Shepherd, who is a great organizer and is my co-founder in the Greater Boston Marxist, which is an organization that we started in college. She started the Lowell Mass Action Collective, which I've been helping her organize under, which has been a great collective pushing for the same abolitionist demands and policies in Lowell to defund Lowell police. And we have been doing care packages with PPE supplies, toilet paper, and different needs for our community. And also just hoping to educate our community on the situations that are happening right now and how getting our communities politically engaged is extremely important as ever.
How do you measure your gains every day? What makes a good day?
A good day can mean when somebody in need in Lowell or in Boston or in Cambridge reaches out to one of our mutual aid funds and asks us for needs and we're able to give it to them. That constitutes a good day for me. When we're able to be able to secure more supplies and more donations for the care packages, that is another good day for me. When we're able to go out into the community and put on these community-led events There was a protest 2 days ago in Lowell to defund the police that was extremely community-led and beautiful and had a chalk talk with people drawing kind of their imaginations of what Lowell could look like without police. That was a beautiful day. And I think really for me, what defines good days and missed progress is when I can see my community coming together and building that power and solidarity and understanding that we do have power and seeing organizations being able to build together and solidarity between Boston and Lowell and Lowell and Brockton and Taunton. There is just so much solidarity happening and a sharing of resource and information that is also what I feel can constitute giving me so much hope that this movement can continue.
Queen Cheyenne Wade, thank you for your work and for speaking with us about it.
Thank you so much.
Carlton Williams is a young 50-year-old activist lawyer who cut his teeth in the American Civil Liberties Union. He's a Bostonian from Rhode Island, the identical twin son of an African-American mother and a father with Native American roots among Narragansett people. I asked Carl Williams to size up the generation rising behind him.
One of the things that inspires me about what's happening right now across the United States and across the world is there are Black people in literal fact dancing in the streets. That for me is a visual that is incredibly powerful. There are young people, they're not even millennials. This is Gen Z. These are people who were born, many of them after, you know, September 11th in 2001. So that's who we're seeing out in the streets. That's who is organizing much of what we're calling the current iteration of the Black Lives Matter movement. And these are people who were born in a world where Barack Obama was already president. That wasn't like a thing that they thought maybe happened, couldn't happen, or inspired by happening. They were just like, and I'll say it in some millennial or Gen Z speak, facts. That's just facts, right? I think them building on the shoulders of folks who came before us and us building on the shoulders of folks who came before, I mean, they started fighting on a level that Black Lives Matter as a movement, as a reality, as a demand already existed, right? Because if we think, you know, when Trayvon Martin was murdered and when George Zimmerman went on trial and when Alicia Garza wrote that cry that ended with the words Black Lives Matter, a lot of the folks who are in the street today, they were probably like 12 or 13 years old when that happened. So maybe a little bit too young to have been out in the streets and chanting, a little bit too young to be in Ferguson, you know, facing, you know, riot police and tanks, but they're damned ready now. And it's stunning to see what they're doing.
Do you remember a moment where you hit your head and said, wait a sec, something's changed. These kids are different.
One of the larger rallies about 5 or 6 weeks ago, organized by some millennials, and we were getting ready there as lawyers and legal workers to support that rally. And I saw like hundreds and hundreds of people walking by me. And it's not my first rodeo. Usually I'll go to a demonstration and I'll know a bunch of the folks there. I saw 400 or 500 people walk by me and I said, I don't know any of these people. That day was a new day. Those people are new people who are ready to fight for, I'll say, for Black liberation, but really as Black liberation as a bellwether for all people, for Black folks, for trans folks, for LGBTQ folks, for women, for poor people, for differently abled people, for Indigenous people. And you see that in the way folks are organizing, who they're bringing in. I mean, from day one, these organizations have been working with the urban Indigenous community in and around Boston. They've been working with, you know, the Arab and Muslim community. They've been working with the undocumented and less documented communities in Boston. But it's really beautiful to see. And that's the thing that's amazing about it is when we talk about, you know, the Kingian concept of a beloved community that Dr. King spoke eloquently about, that's what it looks like.
Cut through the euphoria and look ahead with a lawyer's vision. And you've lost cases as well as won them. But where are we going? And how do you measure the progress?
I take exception. We win when we fight.
Interesting.
When our clients stand up in court and fight, that's when we win, because they say, I want to say what my piece is. And certainly sometimes, you know, folks go to jail. Certainly sometimes when we fight for civil rights, people don't get justice from the courts. But many times people don't expect to get justice from what a lot of my clients say. It's their courts. These courts were not made for us, right? Mm. The constitutional amendments, they specifically said, these are not for you. But I know that people will be free. People will live and be free in all of the ways that that matters. The question is when, and that might be 100 years from now. It could be 500 years from now.
Might be 5 years from now.
It might be 5 years from now. And I know that that day will come sooner, the more people stand up and demand it, right? The New York Times recently said that about 20 to 24% of the population of the United States of America has taken part in some Black Lives Matter protest. Hmm. We know that the American Revolution against, you know, British colonial rule, probably about 12 or 13% of the population said, this is a good idea. We should go to war with the largest imperial power that the world's ever seen. That was 12 or 13% of people. We're talking about double that percentage of people is saying, we need to drastically change. We need to defund police. We need to restructure the way we think about the criminal legal system. And you have a massive swath of American society saying that today. I've never seen this number this broad. I mean, there were protests in Montana and Wyoming and North Dakota, right? And seeing, you know, indigenous people in North Dakota, seeing the Lakota Sioux stand up for Black Lives Matter, seeing people in rural Pennsylvania stand up for Black Lives Matter, seeing people in other countries. I saw a photo of Black Iraqis, which I have to say I didn't know existed. If I thought about it, I probably would have thought they existed, but it was just people who were much darker skinned Black than me who were dressed as, you know, an average person in Iraq would be. And they said, we're standing up for our rights in Iraq, and we're standing up in solidarity with Black people in the United States. And I was like, I need to sit down and think about this for an hour, because it's so stunning, right? I mean, it would be difficult to find a country on earth that Alicia Garza's words, that is Black Lives Matter, haven't been chanted, haven't been marched to, and haven't been held aloft on signs in front of the powers that be.
Carl Williams, there's a thread through so many conversations we've had on the subject. There's a kind of confidence, a kind of serenity. These organizers laugh a lot. They seem to have a broad life, each one of them. You above all, can you explain it?
I'm going to talk about Dr. King again. It's the Kingian mountaintop. We could play a game, Chris. You can pick a decade. You can pick a year in the history of the United States of America. And I can tell you things that, I'll even make it harder, I can tell you things that Black women did in that year that were amazing, that advanced the cause of freedom for all people, not just in the United States, for all over the world. And that is a legacy that we know about. Right. I mean, even here in Boston, like, we could pick a decade and say, what happened here? And you could say, Mel King was there and he was fighting like hell. We can pick another year and we could say, you know, this person was here and they were fighting for our liberation. And that's always happened. And historically, not all the fights we win, but we win pretty often. And knowing that history, and then seeing people, like seeing people at the Massachusetts Bail Fund, seeing people at the Muslim Justice League, seeing people in our local communities who are standing up and saying, people shouldn't be held in jail because they're poor. Mothers shouldn't be giving birth in this state in shackles, right? People shouldn't be bound because of some amount of money that they owe to worry about when they're going to get locked up. People should have safe and affordable housing. People should be safe in their communities. Seeing people struggle for that and talk about it and win battles in relation to it is better than the big law firm job, you know, that some of my colleagues got when they got out of law school. We get paid more. We just get paid in a different way.
Fascinating.
And we get paid in smiles on people's faces, the idea that we're doing what is right and what is leading to human liberation.
Carl Williams, thank you so much for your testimony and for leading this generation.
Thank you.
Thanks to all our spirited voices before Carl Williams, Queen Cheyenne Wade, Fatima Ahmed, Armani White, Ayanna Aalborg, and Andrea James. Please think of supporting Open Source. The best way is by becoming a monthly subscriber on Patreon. You'll get extras like Adam Coleman's ongoing series about reading in a time of social distance. This week, he's talking to Andrew Martin, author of the new collection of stories called Cool for America. Find it at patreon.com/radioopensource. Our show this week was produced by Connor Gillies and Adam Coleman. Mary McGrath is our organized activist. I'm Christopher Ludden. Join us next time for Open Source.